You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
My name is Beka Vucu, and I'm the regional director for the Western Balkans here at the OSF in the New York office. And it's my great pleasure to welcome Sandra Orlović and Mario Mažić, our distinguished guests today, to talk about the former Yugoslavia and, as they put it, is the violent past irreversible? Just couple of words on many of you know the Balkans, many of you don't know the Balkans here or are just interested in the region. And I just want to say a couple of things that fortunately or unfortunately, the focus of the world has shifted from the 90s to other parts where different problems occurred, whether it was the Arab Spring or the things in Africa or Asia, Burma, and so on. However, the Balkans still remain an important ground, not only for the countries where in the Balkans, obviously, but also for wider Europe and as well as for our foundation. We still have offices in our four countries. We have an office in Macedonia, Serbia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and in Kosovo. And we have an advisor's office in Croatia, while in Montenegro we keep our presence but do not have a foundation, working foundation anymore. And in Slovenia, we did close the foundation in 1999, but we have a very good NGO, the Peace Institute, that we work with. So we are actually still, through my office, covering the whole region, the whole Western Balkans, as we call it. I'm together with Sandra and Mario. Hello, this is Nevena coming.
Hi,
with us. We talked a little bit how to schedule this conversation, and we felt that we should divide it in three different parts. The first one would be a part where our guests will introduce themselves and tell us a little bit more about who they are and what they do and about the organizations that represent. Even though you read a little bit in their bios, I think it's also good to hear it from them. The second part we felt, so that will be about 10 minutes or so. The second part we wanted to talk a little bit about what have been the efforts in the Balkans after the conflict, what has been done in order to work on the issues of the transition with justice, reconciliation, and so on. And the two organizations that they represent, the Fund for Humanitarian Law and the Youth Initiative for Human Rights in Croatia, have been really on the helm of these happenings. So we will ask them to reflect not only what the non-governmental organizations did, but what were the attempts also with the governments throughout the region on one side. What were the challenges? What were the difficulties? What were the opportunities for such a development of any kind of work on the reconciliation issues? And we tried to put some kind of a timeline. What does it mean post-conflict? So we said, okay, let's look at the Serbia from the moment of the fall of Milosevic in October 2000. Let's look at Croatia after Tudjman's death in December of 1999. And let's look at Bosnia after the Dayton Accords in November of 1995. So let's look at what happened in that post-conflict era up to, let's say, a month ago. Because what happened a month ago, and that was the decision of the Hague Tribunal on November 16th, the acquittal of the two Croatian generals, Gotovina and Markač, in a way changed the situation in the country. So the third part of our discussion today would be their comments, their view on the acquittals that happened regarding the Croatian generals and 2 days ago, the acquittal of the Albanian Kosovar general Ramush Haradinaj and his two colleagues from KLA. So not to really go more into these details, I would like to ask Sandra and Mario to really take over. Just to pose a couple of questions. Hello, Snežana. Snežana, please come in. So how are these decisions, obviously the decisions that were made in the last acquittals from the ICTY, how are they changing the situation in the region? Are they changing the situation? What is the future of the Hague Court? What is it going to happen? How much is this actually going to really change the position of the governments? What is going to happen with the victims' families? Are people thinking about that? Who then committed these crimes if these guys in Croatia and in Kosovo were acquitted? So there's a huge amount of questions. I'm sure that we will not come here with any answers that are definite, but obviously the two organizations that we are representing, that Sandra and Mario are representing here today, really, as I said in the, previously, are in the helm of really dealing with these issues in two countries, in Serbia and Croatia. So I will ask Sandra to start first. You read a little bit of her bio. Let me just add that both Sandra and Mario are currently fellows of the Alliance for Historical Dialogue and Accountability at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at the Columbia University. And they have been here about 4 months. They're leaving mid-December, going back to Serbia and Croatia. And I think that this is really a good opportunity to really hear them and then hear you. So if you have any questions or you have any comments, let's leave that for the end so that we can wrap up the session that way. Sandra, being very modest in her biography, in the short biography, she did not say that actually from January she's going to be the executive director of the Humanitarian Law Center, meaning that she is going to take the position that Nataša Kandić so far held, and we all, at least majority of us here, know who Nataša Kandić is and her accomplishments through the Humanitarian Law Center. Nataša, of course, is not going to disappear. She's going to stay on the board of the center. She's going to still work. Yes, Murat, hello. Hi. She's going to still work. She's going to be engaged in several projects, of course, that she's doing. And I have to add also that the humanitarian, the Fund for Humanitarian Law has been a long time grantee of the Open Society Foundations. We have helped them not only through the presidential grants, but also through our Human Rights and Governance Grants program. So, Sandra.
Thank you. Sure. Thank you all, because you devoted your lunchtime to hear about Balkan. I said already that I come from Bosnia. I was born there and spent the whole war there. In 1999, I went to Belgrade to study law. When I finished the Faculty of Law in 2004, I started to work with Humanitarian Law Center. So now I'm more than 7 years with the center. In November this year, center celebrated 20 years of its existence. So it is established in November 1992 at the outset of the war in former Yugoslavia, and actually after the first wave of ethnic cleansing in Bosnia-Herzegovina and Croatia. The most important aim of the center through all these years was to document human rights violations in former Yugoslavia. And until today, HLC became one of the most important, if not most important, documentation center about war crimes in former Yugoslavia. We have thousands of statements of victims, witnesses, a very huge media archive in our archive, but also we have more than 95% of the archive of the Hague Tribunal. After the fall of Milosevic, HLC started to design various projects and programs whose aim are to promote accountability for war crimes, to help victims to fulfill their rights for reparations, justice, truth, etc. For example, we are submitting a lot of criminal complaints against perpetrators of war crimes, not just direct perpetrators, but also those one with common responsibility. We submitted one criminal complaint that is the only case where the court examined war crimes against Roma in Bosnia and Herzegovina. We also do a lot of work in order to create comprehensive record of human losses during the war in former Yugoslavia. We are collecting information about human losses in Kosovo, also about human losses of citizens of Serbia and Montenegro who died during the war in Bosnia and Croatia, human losses during the NATO bombardment, etc. At this moment, we are in the phase of developing non-formal programs, programs of non-formal education about the past, about the judicially established facts, about war crimes, about mechanisms of transitional justice, etc. So I think it is enough.
Mario, coming from Zagreb, is the head of an interesting organization that has actually offices and is connected with similar organizations in Belgrade, in Sarajevo, in Kosovo, in Pristina. And so let's hear a little bit about him and about your organization. What do you do regionally?
Well, I'm Mario.
From Split, I assume. Right?
No, no, I'm actually from Petrinja, which is a small town, some 50 kilometers from Zagreb, from the capital. And during the war, I lived in Sisak, which is very close because Petrinja was occupied. And I moved to Zagreb to college and live there. And I work with the Youth Initiative for Human Rights. It's a regional network of organizations. That share the name and the basic vision and mission and work in five countries of the former Yugoslavia, in Croatia, Bosnia, Serbia, Kosovo, and Montenegro. But during the last 3 or so years, our mandates changed a little bit in every country, focusing on the situation on the ground and also the civil society situation and things like that. So, for example, the Youth Initiative in Serbia does a lot of advocacy and public actions and things like that, and they don't really deal with direct work in transitional justice because there is the HLC that does this work, for example, whereas we in Croatia are more focused on transitional justice mechanisms. We work through some four basic programs. One is the transitional justice, and I'll talk about that a bit later. We have a youth program where we work with young people, mostly again on transitional justice topics, but also democratization and some local issues. And here we have a pretty wide network of young people, activists, that do some sort of small-scale actions. And the biggest one they participated was the RECOM signature collection campaign, where around 200 young people in Croatia participated in collecting signatures for the establishment of a regional commission, which we'll talk about later. We have a regional program through which we cooperate with other offices in the region. The biggest program we do there is a regional exchange that has been going on since 2003 between Serbia and Kosovo. The exchange program between young people, mostly from Pristina and Belgrade, and then from Serbia and Kosovo, other places as well. And we do it on a regional level also, in a way to build a new generation, to build new ties after the conflict. And now, since there is no need to do it between other countries in a way that it's being done still between Kosovo and Serbia, we formulated around some bigger regional events like the Sarajevo Film Festival or events like that. And right now in December, we'll have the second youth summit in Pristina this time, where we gather some decision makers from the European Union, from the local countries and youth organizations from the region, and try to make it as a platform where youth organizations will manage to transmit this message of a new generation in a way to decision makers. And finally, our transitional justice program, where we don't do systematic documentation and documentation of human rights losses like the HLC does and document in Croatia and the Research and Documentation Center in Sarajevo, but we focus on some cases where there is, in a way, a political problem. And in this sense, we identified three groups of cases that we work on. Two of them we worked on so far, one of them we're preparing to work on. One is sexual crimes that are not getting prosecuted in Croatia, actually, or not getting prosecuted adequately, where the ICTY has a very well-developed practice, and in Croatia we have a very bad legal framework where it comes to that. And in a few days we're going to publish a discussion report about the practice of the ICTY and domestic practice and practice in some other jurisdiction and try to amend the law on criminal proceedings to allow for better prosecution of wartime rape. Then there are widely put crimes of Croatian forces that where there is, in a way, a political problem to get them prosecuted, and especially crimes of committed by high-level officials and people that are still powerful. And third, the crimes in Bosnia and Herzegovina, which some of them have been prosecuted at the ICTY, but nothing has been prosecuted at domestic courts in Croatia, at least. So I think I'm going to stop here also
okay.
about your
great. Thank you, Mario. So let's then move to the second part, which I think is much more substantial in answering our question. And let me just repeat for the couple of you who came later. We would like to ask both Sandra and Mario to talk a little bit about what has been happening and what has been achieved, I would say, and what are the different forms of and mechanisms of the transitional justice that have been happening in the countries of the former Yugoslavia. So not only on the side of the civil society, but also on the side of the governments. And how do they see that develop in the future, obviously, in the view of the decisions of the ICTY from November 16th and November 28th with the acquittals of these war criminals. So we can talk. We will talk a little bit about the RECOM. We're going to talk about other things. And so here you go, Sandra.
Yeah, this conversation would look like much different, I believe, if it was held 1 month ago, before these judgments in cases Gotovina and Haradinaj. But in any case, we need to be clear and certain that even 1 month ago the situation was not so bright, and that we were very far from reconciliation between people and between ethnic communities. And we need to go one step back and maybe to try to assess some measures that were implemented both by international community and also by national states in terms of facing with the past. And these conditions are kind of formal preconditions for even to start speaking about reconciliation. The most important pillar of the transitional justice in former Yugoslavia is for sure International Criminal Tribunal for Former Yugoslavia, which was established in 1993. And it definitely had its very important role because it ended impunity. And I think the most important role of ICTY is in the fact that even during the war and immediately after the war, it sent a clear symbolic message to victims and the communities that justice can be served somewhere, not in their countries, but somewhere. Because during the war and immediately after the war, states were not interested to try to perpetrators, even the most brutal murderers, let alone the state officials and generals, etc. And also, I can say that ICTY did a great contribution to opening these archives, secret archives of our state. So I believe that this archive will be very valuable in the future for any kind of process whose aim is reconciliation. But, you know, on the side of each particular state, I can say that there were some measures, but they are very poor and deficient. For example, since 2004, each state is trying its own perpetrators of war crimes. In Serbia, we have war crimes, we have specialized chamber and prosecutor office. And until now, that office indicted more than 160 persons for war crimes in Kosovo, Croatia, and Bosnia. But my organization is very critical towards the work of war crime prosecutor office in Serbia, because we see that they are not independent institutions; they are under a huge influence of the politicians, and we can see that mainly in the fact that. They are very hesitant to indict high-level or mid-level officers of Serbian military or Serbian police. So you have the situation where ICTY indicted and tried the highest state officials, generals of military and police, and you have our prosecutor office who is focusing only on direct perpetrators. So you have the whole wide middle range state officials and officers who are living freely. Actually, one of them is today's chief of the Serbian military general staff. He was a commander of one unit in Kosovo, in the region of Drenica, where around 600 Albanian civilians were killed. So, you know, there was no any proceedings against him, no lustration. Serbia adopted, actually, during the Djindjic government, adopted a law on lustration, but that law was never implemented. Of course, not to mention our current president, Nikolic, who was a member of paramilitary unit who was deployed in Croatia, and Prime Minister Ivica Dačić, who was the closest associate of Slobodan Milošević. In Serbia, we have some kind of state-sponsored reparation programs, but these reparation programs are outrageous. You know, the several categories of victims are not entitled to any kind of support to states. For example, victims of sexual violence, families of missing persons, victims who suffered violence from Serbian police and military. And all these things, all these few things that I mentioned, were kind of out of the radar of European Union all these years. And you know probably that that European Union is the most important international interlocutor for Serbia and also for other post-Yugoslav countries. And all these years of the process of integration of Serbia into European Union, the main focus of European Union was cooperation with the Hague Tribunal. All other issues like reparation, lustrations, war crime trials were kind of out of their radar. You asked and mentioned what are the challenges, what are the opportunities and difficulties. I think one of the most important challenges for civil society in Serbia is to try to sensitize European Union more about these issues of transitional justice. To try to see what should be the comprehensive strategy in terms of facing the legacy of the past, not just put the conditions like reform of judiciary or rule of law, or, you know, I think that the former Yugoslavia needs a different approach. And also the biggest challenge is, of course, the present political elites, who are totally unsensitive to questions of the past. They would rather forget it and go immediately in the European Union. So, yeah, this is our current situation. And since these flaws of the transitional justice mechanisms are not just, you know, endemic for Serbia, they can be identified for in all other post-Yugoslav countries. We also, as a civil society in former Yugoslavia, have gathered around one idea that post-Yugoslav countries should sit together and form interstate truth commission, which will enable victims from all sides to give their testimonies. That commission should also create human losses register in the wars during the 90s, and many other things that we need as a society in terms of facing with the past. Mario will speak a little bit more about that. I will stop here.
Sure.
Well, I would just like to say that the first, you know, the breakup of Yugoslavia was followed by five or six, depends how you look at it, conflicts in the region that left more than around 130,000 people killed, millions displaced, destroyed properties, refugees. Still today, there's around 14,000 people missing, and this is in a way a legacy that tried to be addressed and needs to be addressed in that sense. And the ICTY, as Sandra said, indicted a total of 161 persons, and in a way the mandate of the ICTY was to try the most responsible persons, the top-level officials. We will assess it probably after it's done with its work, but I'm sure that now we can already say, and we can talk about it in third part, that it's dubious in what way they achieved that or not. Domestic war crime trials are going pretty slow, and we have them in all countries now, except for Macedonia, where they have, in a way, the granted legal immunity in that sense. And as Sandra said, there are problems with domestic prosecutions, mostly coming from, in a way, some sort of political pressure of the community, and especially when it comes to high-level officials and persons who are still powerful in politics or in judiciary, in military, it's hard to get them prosecuted. When it comes to domestic prosecutions in Croatia, and I would just like to emphasize something that Sandra said, that the European Union, throughout this whole time, she said that during the accession process of the countries into the European Union, it focuses on the ICTY. And that is one permanent strategy it has. It doesn't have a constant and clear strategy when it comes to other mechanisms of transitional justice, and it should be apparent to them that local politicians are not going to do much more without international pressure. And in that way, everything that has been done on domestic prosecutions has been done with some pressure either from the international community or under the pressure of civil society, of course a little less because we as civil society do not really have the power and to pressure them in that sense. So as I said earlier, in Croatia now we have a problem with the prosecution of high-level officials. We have problems with prosecution of perpetrators on the behalf of Croatian army. There wasn't even a strategy from the European Union to pressure Croatia to establish a separate prosecution office or a separate court to prosecute war crime cases. So we have a prosecution office that deals with corruption, with all other cases and war crimes. And finally, now at the end of the negotiations, there was some pressure for Croatia to at least move the prosecutions of war crimes from local courts to the four biggest county courts, which happened, and now this is taking place like this, but still it's not enough because the judges prosecute corruption cases and war crimes cases and are definitely overburdened and not specialized enough to deal with that. You might know Croatia closed accession negotiations with the European Union and is supposed to join the EU in July next year. When it comes to reparations, mechanisms vary from country to country a lot, but in neither of the countries is there, in a way, a systematic approach to the question of reparations. And we now see that some cases at the European Court of Human Rights are getting raised, and some issues might get dealt with in that way. But it's very little. And Sandra noticed earlier today that through the politicians' reactions to the judgment in Serbia, you can really see that there is no empathy with victims, but rather decriminalizing the policies of the 90s. And this is the problem. They don't have this approach to the rights of victims to deal with reparation in that sense. When it comes to truth-seeking and fact-finding, there were a couple of efforts in the region, very bad ones. Sandra might say a bit more about the Koštunica's commission. There was a commission in Srebrenica that, for example, in its mandate had to deal with cars that have been missing or ruined, but not missing persons. And in Croatia, for example, we have a center established by the parliament that is called the Documentation Center for the Homeland War. We call it the Homeland War for some reason. One journalist wrote it, and Tudjman liked it and then took it. He probably didn't know that the Russians called the World War II the Homeland War and things like that. But so it deals very nationalistically in a way with it has a role to support the dominant narrative that was adopted in the declaration on the Homeland War. So the truth-seeking mechanisms that existed kind of went in that direction to strengthen the dominant narratives that exist. There has been no vetting or illustration efforts in Croatia whatsoever, especially because we had the same party in power in the 90s, and then between 2000 and 2003 we had the coalition government, and then between 2003 and last year we had the same party in power. And just to sum up the challenges that now exist, I think the biggest challenge is actually twofold. One, for the European Commission to continue pressure on Croatia after it joins the European Union. We as civil society really felt the switch. In one moment we had cooperation with the European delegation, we had their support, they were coming to events of civil society, things like that. And then when negotiations got close to an end, then the delegation completely switched its focus from the civil society to the institutions, and now they're the partners, and we are boring them the same way we are boring domestic institutions. And this is going to be a serious problem if the European Union doesn't take a strong attitude for some post-accession mechanisms for Croatia to deal better with some remaining issues. And the other thing, after this judgment that we'll talk about later, in Croatia now we have an idea that a war just ended. With this judgment, we have dealt with everything we could. And in that way, you know, Gotovina, the acquitted one, said, now this is over, let's focus on the future. And in a way, all the politicians greeted that. They mentioned that we need to prosecute some of the crimes, but that's it. And this is where the RECOM initiative, in a way, comes in. It's a civil society initiative started by three organizations, Sandra's organization, Documenta, and Research and Documentation Center. But now it has over 1,800 organizations in the coalition advocating for the establishment of a regional fact-finding mechanism, of a regional truth commission. This commission would be tasked with establishing facts about all victims of war crimes and other serious human rights violations committed between 91 and 2001. It could also deal with some issues committed later, if it's in relation to the war, for example, attacks on witnesses and things like that. Through a very wide consultation process that was participated by over 8,000 people in the region, from victims groups, women's groups, youth groups, human rights organizations, international experts, jurists, even politicians, journalists, historians, many different groups, we have developed a mandate of the commission that we propose to the presidents in the region to, in a way, start the process of establishment of RECOM. The initiative has gained international support from the European Commission, the European Parliament, the Council of Europe. in some way a support from the State Department and some local politicians like the Croatian president, the former Serbian president, and some other presidents in the region. In Montenegro, we have the biggest support for some reason again. And but in a way, the process is now at the moment where we have collected over 500,000 signatures of citizens in support of RECM, made this entire consultation process, wrote the mandate, proposed it, and now it's turning the politicians to make this step forward. And in this situation, we now really see that RECM could, in a way, come in where this approach without a clear strategy failed, obviously. But we'll see, we can talk a little more about that later when we come to questions. But
thank you. I just have one question. Can anybody of you tell me a little bit more about the role of the courts in Bosnia, the local courts in Bosnia? Because you address Serbia and Croatia, but Bosnia obviously is certainly an important link. And what is the situation? Is it better than in Serbia or Croatia, or is it the same, or what is the situation in those courts?
I can just, you can add. I think that state court in Bosnia, who is in charge for trying cases of war crimes, does the best work in the region. Of course, that court is facing with another type of challenges, and that is a huge number of war crimes. As I know, I think 10,000 cases are waiting, pending, mm-hmm. to be prosecuted. So, mm-hmm. Of course, they have maybe they have bigger resources than other courts in the region, but still, it's a huge challenge to deal with. So. Yeah, besides state court, there are district courts or cantonal courts in both in Federation and Republika Srpska who are also dealing with mm-hmm. the small-scale crimes. But mm-hmm. yeah, I think the expectations of victims are something that mm-hmm. it's very hard to handle with. And there is always room when you wait for such a long for justice, there is always room to say, a space to say that is because of the politics, because state prosecutor of Bosnia Herzegovina does not want to prosecute the crimes which were committed against Serbs. And I can understand frustration of victims from both sides because, around 15 years they are
waiting. Yeah, just to say, I said that. Oh, around 130,000 people were killed in the region. Out of that, around 100,000 were killed in Bosnia and Herzegovina. So the court of Bosnia and Herzegovina definitely has the biggest job in that sense. And the state court of Bosnia and Herzegovina is in a way a hybrid type court. So it has domestic and international prosecutors and judges there and officials. And it is definitely, compared to other courts in the region, doing the most professional work when it comes to that. But as Sandra said, and as you can see from the numbers, it's definitely overburdened. And the only thing that might that was a problem in Bosnia in the cooperation of the district courts and the state court, there were some issues in overlapping, as the local courts saw it, in a way. Mm-hmm. I'm talking a few months ago, we finished a report that dealt with that also, and there was this issue that there is some overlapping and district courts want to have more role in this sense or less. But the overburdening of this court mm-hmm. is the biggest case, and I think in a way there is, in the lack of other mechanisms, everybody is seeking justice, but it's actually impossible to imagine a situation where every war crime is prosecuted in court.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm sure that many of you have questions, but let's just move now to the present situation, which is pretty bleak. as Sandra said, a month ago, the discussion would have gone the other way. But a month ago, we were faced as a huge surprise that the ICTY's judgment to acquittal Gotovina came, to his surprise as well. Let's comment on that particular decision of the ICTY, plus the decision of Haradinaj's group just 2 days ago, 3 days ago, and how is that going to change the situation? And then we're going to open the question for questions. Snežana is here, who is a media expert, a professor from the University of Belgrade in political science, presently a Fulbrighter. Maybe she can tell us a little bit of the role of the media in this particular. We have Nevena here as well, who is a human rights advocate, a lawyer from Belgrade, a professor also at Belgrade University. Anybody else? Adna, if you have any questions. But let's kind of focus a little bit on this Gotovina and Haradinaj and see what is actually happening.
Well, just to say first, when it comes to these two judgments, I'm not sure they can be seen as, you know, the same problem in a way.
Okay.
I see a huge difference.
Can you explain that to us who are not?
Well, to start, the Gotovina trial was this biggest military action ever conducted by the Croatian forces in August 95, called the Operation Storm, liberated one third of the Croatian territory that was before that occupied, but as a result, around 200,000 Serbs from Croatia fled. Around 20,000 Serbian properties were destroyed, and between 600 and 700 Serbs were killed, civilians. So obviously, a huge amount of crimes was committed in just a few days of the operation and a few months after it. The ICTY indicted three people for that: Gotovina, Čermak, and Markač. Markač was acquitted on the first level judgment, as they said that he wasn't a part of the joint criminal enterprise. As the court established on the first level judgment that there was a joint criminal enterprise from the Croatian leadership at that time to ethnically cleanse the territory and remove permanently Serbs from Croatia. And Gotovina and Markač, Gotovina, who was a military commander of the operation, and Markač, who was a special police forces commander in part, were found guilty and sentenced to 24 and 18 years in prison. And on the 16th of November, the appeals chamber reversed the entire finding on the existence of the joint criminal enterprise, said the joint criminal enterprise did not exist, and acquitted both Gotovina and Markač, and questioned their guilt under the alternative forms of responsibility, and found them innocent in that way too, and completely acquitted them. In the appeals chamber, there are five judges at the ICTY. This judgment was brought by the majority 3-2. Two judges, very distinguished judges, were completely dissenting from the judgment, and in a way and with a language that I've never seen before in a judgment, calling some conclusions
misleading, misconstructing,
and what was
grotesque.
The strongest? Grotesque. Yes. Grotesque, and Judge Pokar, in the end, usually they say I respectfully dissent. He said I fundamentally dissent from the whole judgment that has no something like connection to sense of justice. The problem was that the grounds on which the finding was reversed are very slim. There were five elements to joint criminal enterprise as found by the first level judgment. This judgment only dealt with, I would say, one and a half, and on the basis of that reversed the finding. So in that sense, the judgment really opens a space for questioning it from the perspective of rights of victims, but also from a legal standpoint. I would not talk a lot about the legal standpoint because I'm not a lawyer. I read a few legal analysis after that and the dissenting opinions. But it's, in that sense, very problematic and controversial. Now, social repercussions and political repercussions of this judgment are huge because, as I said, this Operation Storm, wide-range war crimes were committed in it. Still, not a single murder from the Operation Storm is prosecuted in Croatia at domestic courts. We don't have a single final judgment for murders in or after the Operation Storm. So the victims, and among Serbian victims, among the Serbian community, this is seen as the biggest crime committed in the 90s against Serbs, and there is no justice for them whatsoever here. So from the point of rights of victims, it's there's actually nothing to talk about here because the judgment and the justice mechanisms elsewhere didn't bring justice at all.
Yeah. Can you just tell us a little bit the reaction in Croatia to the among the government people as well as the civil society?
Well,
how can you? You were not in Zagreb when it happened. You were in New York, but still, we all saw television. We all read everything that was written. But if you can tell to our to people here who do not read Croatian or Serbian newspapers, and then we'll ask Sandra to give us the reaction in Serbia.
Well, the situation in Croatia was incredibly festive. It was it looked like a huge party. All the way, and I published an article when the process was finishing saying how the media are only focusing on the destiny of these two guys or these three guys and completely disregarding the victims. We know that Gotovina is a good lover, that he paints. We don't know if any of the victims painted. We don't know their names. We know nothing about them. And they were always seen as innocent. Even after the first level judgment, all the politicians in Croatia had unacceptable statements, including President Josipović, who promotes the regional cooperation and reconciliation. He said, and he's a law professor, he said that a judgment is unacceptable, that we cannot accept it, that it has no legal grounds even, and funny things like that. And the prime minister was a different one, but even this, today's prime minister, said very similar statements, and they focused a lot of efforts on a lot of money to come up with a legal analysis of the judgment to help the generals in their defense and things like that. So when this judgment was rendered, a government airplane was sent in The Hague to pick up the two generals in half an hour. Minister of Defense and Minister of Defenders, we have that, went to The Hague to pick them up. When they came back to Zagreb, to Plesa, there was a red carpet, and the president of the parliament and the prime minister were there waiting for them. Then they went to the main square, where there was a huge gathering, and finally to an official reception and dinner at the president's office. And the minister of defenders announced that they will be next year awarded the special recognitions, in a way, decorations for their efforts in freeing the country. So this was the reaction in Croatia generally, and we in civil society were kind of completely left alone because even though the president and the prime minister mentioned that crimes should be prosecuted, of course, but now there is this sense that all the crimes that were committed are just isolated incidents. They were not part of the plan. They were not part of the criminal policy. So, in a way, dealing with the past is finished. Gotovina himself, when he came to the main square, said, "This is done, let's focus on the future." This is what is going on now in Croatia. And in a way, we as civil society now have to push for something that is maybe even impossible, to get some people who have command responsibility for these crimes to get prosecuted, to show that it's not isolated events. But I'm not sure that Croatian judiciary has the ability to do that.
Vesna Teršović, who is the director of Documenta, one of the most important organizations and NGOs in Croatia who deals with the dealing with the past said that this brings them back 15 years, where they were 15 years ago, and it will take them this many time to come where they were on the 15th of November. And in Serbia, obviously, was a different reaction to this. So you were, again, not in Belgrade and in Serbia, but if you can just give us a very short insight, what did the president and the prime minister say, as well as what is the position of the civil society and your organization?
Well, on the scale of human emotions, you know, emotions in Croatia and in Serbia regarding this judgment in totally opposite sides. Anger and you know, screaming and everything what I have read in the media, and maybe Professor Milivojević can give a more expert opinion about it, but it was really bad. Bad. And, you know, emotions on the side of victims can be understood, really, from the human point of view. This another judgment, Haradinaj, came very fast after Gotovina judgment. Haradinaj was one of the commanders of Kosovo Liberation Army in Kosovo during the war in Kosovo. He was very influential, and there is no doubt that under his command, around 60 or 70 Serb, Roma, and Albanian civilians were killed during 1998 and 1999. But I want just to emphasize what Mario just said, that these two cases are really different, and they each illuminate another set of problems. Gotovina case is problematic both from legal point of view, but also from a factual point of view, because legal findings of the appeal chamber does not coincide with the what we have on the ground now, 15 years after the Operation Storm. I think the consequences of Gotovina judgment will be seen also in the international humanitarian law, and how in the similar cases court will react and which standards they will apply. But that's another story. When it comes to Haradinaj, I think this also is very important to, this case underlines again how it's difficult to try KLA commanders and members because of the crimes which they committed against Serbs in Kosovo, because Kosovo is a very small community, witness protection is very hard, and we don't have any case of war crimes trials against KLA officers in Kosovo for crimes against Serbs because of the witness protection. So this really puts a big question mark for EULEX and international community how to proceed with it, because we see this is really a big problem. But when it comes to reactions in Serbia, I just want to emphasize that Serbian public was never well informed about the work of ICTY. And that was not just the guilt of the ICTY, but also the Serbian politicians who were always trying somehow to hide what is happening there. Hide the victims' testimonies from Kosovo, from Bosnia, from Serbia. For example, when the first instance judgment against it's a case called Kosovo 6, those were the president of Serbia and five other highest police and military generals, which were accused for horrible crimes against Kosovo Albanians in Kosovo. When that judgment was rendered, they were all convicted except president of Serbia, Milan Milutinović. There was no any kind of discussion in Serbian society what that judgment means, what were the evidences about victims, and even our Minister of Interior, of Foreign Minister at that time, Vuk Jeremić, who is now presiding the General Assembly of the United Nations, he said, well, some bad things happened in Kosovo, but we need to see how to keep Kosovo in the territory and sovereignty of. So that's a kind of immature attitude of Serbian political elite towards the work of ICTY during the...
Well, many of the politicians didn't even believe from the day one that there should be a court, and they did not believe that it's a regular thing to have it. Anyway, thank you very much. So we have another half an hour or so for questions, comments, and there's a lot to cover, but I hope that you guys will have something to say, so please. Who wants to start first?
Can I ask a question?
Adna, sure, please. Adna is our colleague in the Washington, D.C. office.
So I've been trying to find in the news, you know, has there been any kind of commentary or backlash against the judges that ruled in favor of Kotorna and Lakač? Do we know, what do we know about that? I'm just curious, what has been the reaction towards them and fellow colleagues within The Hague and so on?
Well, there has been, I only saw mentioning of the three of the majority judges in Croatian media as people who deserve statues in Croatian towns, and in Serbian media commentary about the two dissenting judges as people who deserve statues in Serbian towns. I've only seen commentary like that. I haven't seen a lot of attacks on the dissenting judges in Croatian media, but nobody really focuses on the judgment. Nobody cares. Whenever there is a judgment, everybody just focuses on whether somebody's found guilty or acquitted and how many years in jail they got. And then they, when Šljivančanin got 5, nobody cared why. Everybody just said, oh, only 5, that's too little. He should have gotten 45 or something. You know, everybody approaches it from that standpoint, which is no professional, not informed. So that's, in a way, the problem. But
when in Serbia, the main argument and the main claim is that because of the president of the appeal chamber is Theodore Meron, American judge, that this is the obvious evidence that America had influenced this judgment because of the participation of the CIA during the Operation Storm. So that's a kind of discourse in Serbian public.
Adna, if I can just add on, and I have here some facts that I got from our colleague in The Hague, Mirko Hlarin, who is the journalist who I think is one of the best informed people about what's happening in The Hague. On May 22nd, 2011, the president, the ICT president at that time, Patrick Robinson, appoints the appeals chamber. 5 judges: Gani, Pokar, Vaz, Meron, and Agius. Right?
Agius.
And then on May 30th, Theodore Meron, the American judge, actually designate himself as the pre-appeal judge, and he is after confirmed. So he actually was the one who wanted to be the president, and then he changes one of the judges, correct?
And puts Patrick Robinson.
And puts Patrick or Robinson to be one of the 5 judges. So there is some kind of a muddy waters there already. So I haven't seen anything, but I'm sure I can send you a couple of sites that I got directly from Mirko Hlarin.
For Serbs who are champions in the conspiracy theories, this is heaven.
This is heaven. This is absolute heaven. That there is obviously some muddiness here. So
there was actually a very funny reaction, very stupid but very funny, from the former president of Croatia, Stipe Mesić, because the church a day before the judgment organized the wakings and people were praying all over Croatia. And then he said that church shouldn't be followed all the time because they were organizing these wakings. Mm-hmm. And 2 Catholic judges were dissenting, and the Protestant were acquitted, the guy.
Yeah,
so.
Thanks, Adna, for the question. We didn't answer it, but we just gave you a little bit of information.
No, that's good. Thank you. And if you can send me what you said, those articles and some information, I'm just curious. You know, I love conspiracy theories.
Sure.
You have it all on ICTY cases, Gotovina, and then courts, president's decisions, and you can find it there. Yeah, there.
Okay.
Questions?
Maybe some comments and questions.
Nevena,
my name is Nevena. And I'm a human rights activist, first of all, child rights activist, and I teach international public law at the Faculty of Law, Union University. And I keep facing the same problem all the time with my students, because they're always angry with international courts and tribunals. And in spite of all the downsides, I always try to advocate and say how beneficial they are, whether they are hybrid, whether they are Sierra Leone, here and there. But there is one major issue why I think this is happening. And I mean, we can speculate, but first of all, the ICTY was established through a resolution. So it's not a court which is established through international document, like international criminal court. So the procedure of selection of judges initially is totally different. And this is why these courts, which are kind of established by a simple decision of an international organization, are not equally good. And I mean, we see problems as with length of processes, and of course these the last events, they dwarf whatever wonderful work was done by these courts. But yet, you know, when you think about Shashan and his case lasting for how long? 10 years.
Yes.
What do I say to my students when I tell them there is the first law is, you know, to adjudicate someone as soon as possible? To, I mean, that's a human right. And then you have a guy sitting there for 10 years. So I don't know when we and how we are going to solve this problem now. This is res judicata, so it's finished. There is nothing no one can do about that. But with regards to that, just a comment or with regards to impartiality of the judges and the structure of the court, that simply judges on ICC, for example, International Criminal Court, wouldn't have that kind of, you know, authority to appoint, move on their own, and it's a broader representation. And the other thing about reconciliation, for those who don't know, in Serbia we are still struggling. Maybe we already forgot, but we have to finish that. We are still struggling with victims of atrocities after the Second World War. This is a big plus Goli Otok, which Serbia never acknowledged. So I mean, how are we going to reconcile for something that happened 20 years ago, 15 years ago, if we can't? There are still now children of those who actually were perpetrators after the Second World War. They are actually advocating against it. And we're talking about 15 to 30,000 people who were killed just for nothing, without any judgment or anything. So, you know, you cannot solve one situation without solving the other. You have to have a holistic approach with human rights. So either you solve everything, there is a movement, okay, we want to deal with these issues in our society. So, this was just my comment.
Thanks. Okay. Do you want to comment on
that? I just want to say that luckily or not, the Serbian government is very much active in solving and finding mass graves which contain victims of communist regime after the Second World War. So they are very much, they're much more active, for example, in finding these victims than Albanian victims and mass graves with Albanian victims, which are, as according to some police officials, still in Serbia. But, you know.
For another 60 years.
Okay. Shall we move? Yes. Snježana.
I see that this is the seniority principle.
Can you just introduce yourself? Because we're taping this so that we have.
Thank you. My name is Snježana Milivojević, and I'm teaching media studies in Belgrade, and I am a visiting fellow at Columbia University. So I was happily distanced from Serbia when all this was happening, enjoying my ocean in between. But there is no escape from the past, not individually, not collectively, obviously. And I was, of course, involved in a discussion, although as many of the people there and here, I'm not a lawyer, so that's the best position to comment on legal cases always. So I really don't know anything about the legals, except from what I've seen from several legal debates, but that doesn't qualify me. But I think the verdict had a major impact on the region, and despite whatever you've been trying to say, I think it's coming in a package, both acquittals happening in a week or 2 weeks apart. And I think it's the general perception throughout the region that this is a package and that this is the end to a sentence. So I'm talking about social consequences or, I don't know, cultural or human consequences, humanitarian consequences. And I think it's almost a universal reading that this was a political wrapping up of the war. So nobody expected the court to be the final political interpret what was happening in the past 15 years. But I think it's exactly what happened. From reading the comments of readers in major media sites, both in Croatia and Serbia, you can see that clearly. The political discourse in both sides is formulating that as well. Political leaders are doing that, I think, unanimously. Political leaders in Croatia openly, political leaders in Serbia by sort of some of them trying to moderate the debate, but unsuccessfully. The consequences for civil society and the reconciliation are really unforeseeable at the moment. You said something about the Croatian impossible position of civil society in Croatia. That's likewise in Serbia. You know, a friend told me the other day this had an effect of the bombing, the 99 bombardment. So who is going to stand up and advocate? Everybody. Every single friend that talked to me told me, even Nataša Kandić is agreeing with the politicians, you know, that even the sentencing, the phrasing of the sentence means that there's no room for dissenting voices. There's no room for dissenting voices. And then this, I'm not saying that this was the remit of the Hague Tribunal to think about the position of civil society in Serbia, but the court didn't have a political role. You know, all these societies were not able to, they were struggling with the past, and they were happy to wrap up, to pack up their dirty parts of history and send them to The Hague, expecting that miraculously something will come out of that. It didn't. And it was from the beginning, you know, like some, I am following the media and the public debate in these countries. During the first trials, early trials, there were attempts, for instance, I remember that I came back to Serbia when there was a strong push to broadcast Milosevic's trials at the time, and I was always asking, who is watching that? You know, who is watching that? Is this the only place where his supporters can cheer and see their beloved leader and follow the story? What's the effect of that? No one ever studied what was the effect. The broadcast of the trials sort of died. It withered away because it became obvious that it was not achieving the effect. I don't know why the expectation of the international community and the judges and legal experts was that this was a case of some dark ages event that no one knew about in the country, and then if they open the court proceedings, we will all suddenly see what was going on, and in a eureka moment we will all become socially responsible beings. It wasn't happening. It didn't stimulate public debate. I didn't see a single, I even tried personally to say, well, let's talk about it. Okay, we have these journalists, international communities put up a international house in The Hague, Mirko Klarin as well. You know, they were correspondents. There was a friendly mood among them, like that's a tough analogy, like the prisoners in The Hague, you know, they they share, yeah, but it didn't stimulate any public debate in the country. So it just, you know, for many in the society, it gave this sort of alibi. Okay, it's happening somewhere else. So the debate in the region did not connect to what was going on in The Hague. This was an isolated island of unsuccessful reconciliation. I'm not talking about legal consequences of the proceedings, but I'm talking about social consequences. In the meantime, of course, the negative, I'm sorry, I don't want to talk about Islam, but the negative image of the court, of course, due to many complexities, was built up in each of these communities, so it's always either or. You know, you can always say, well, this was a verdict from The Hague, but you can always also, use the verdict against international justice or attempts, or any attempt to settle up with the past. So it didn't achieve that role.
Yeah, I just wanted to say on that note that although, you know, I don't believe there was strong political influence on the judges in the tribunal generally, but in a way the decision who will get prosecuted in the prosecution office is a political decision. And we will now have the result of the ICTY that not a single Croatian official is prosecuted for the crimes committed in Croatia. Not a single one. We have the Norac Ademi case, which was transferred to domestic.
That's true.
Court in Norac was found guilty, Ademi was acquitted. The Croatian institutions never followed up on that case, although they should in the cases of two more persons. And Gotovina and Markoč and Čermak were acquitted. So not a single person will have a final judgment at the ICTY from Croatian. And that's a huge problem. I mean, we are aware of the fact that President Tudjman would definitely end up in The Hague, died. Šušak died.
We don't know.
And Bobetko was supposed to go and then died on purpose.
Begovic was never under investigation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Please, Sandra.
Yeah, comment. Just one comment. I fully agree with Snežana that we lack. That we lacked meaningful discussion which would follow the ICT work of ICTY, I fully agree. And we always advocated that the facing with the past must be state project, not the projects of NGOs, which at the end comes to that we are NGOs trying to do the job of the state. It's not ours to initiate some issues, to press the government, but at the end of story, states should do that. The legacy of the war during the 90s is so heavy, and the war has its roots in Second World War, so it's very easy to predict that we are maybe facing in the second generation that we were facing with the new war. So how come that our politicians do not see that this is so important, that it's...
They will not see. Look at Turkish. I mean, do they still see... Sorry, I didn't know you were Turkish. Sorry about that. I mean, it's totally political decision, but there is also an interesting point. We take it for granted that psychologically or socially or for whatever other reason, reconciliation is essential. Once I spent the whole day with high-level delegation from Rwanda, and actually it was an expert meeting with them, and they were actually reporting on the implementation of human rights. And then we started asking about reconciliation, and they said that their official policy is that they will not deal with, they will not go for reconciliation. They want to put behind everything, okay, high-level courts, judgments, but then the rest goes to local Akacha courts. These are the little tribal courts. And that's it. They said, and you know, we were very surprised because we come from this kind of social mindset where we believe that reconciliation is essential. They say, but for how long? I mean, can we really live with that all the time, feeling bad, someone feeling bad, someone feeling guilty? Courts, yes. Disputes, yes. But I mean, we have to get rid of that feeling. I wouldn't know. I'm not a psychologist. That's an interesting concept.
I'm just not sure that Rwanda and Balkans can be compared in that sense, because the genocide in Rwanda was committed by, you know, in a way, ordinary people with machetes, whereas we have a huge responsibility on behalf of the institutions, the military, the commanders, the politicians, the policies. So it's very different in that sense. And you know, now we are in a situation that a reconciliation process is kind of.
There are some societies who decided that they don't want to deal with the past, Spain, Mozambique, or just like let's forget it. But since we already have some kind of mechanisms like Hague Tribunal, then we need to see what to do with it.
Of course,
we cannot pretend that it's not there.
But also, everybody is saying that the one of the most important preconditions for the solving the issues in the Balkans is number one. And it comes number one, not only because of the accession process to the European Union, but number one is actually to dealing with the past. And only if reconciliation or some kind of dealing with the past is happening in the Balkans, that the situation through that could then be solved. How is it now going to be? I'm just asking questions, I'm not asking for answers. The talks between Serbia and Kosovo need to continue. On December 3rd, as we read in the papers the other day, Prime Minister Dačić is going to meet again with Dači. Maybe with Haradina in the past if he becomes the Prime Minister of Kosovo, right? Which are the rumors. So how, I don't want an answer, but I'm saying, how is that going to go forward?
And also another question, Croatia and Serbia are suing each other for genocide
correct.
In 91 and 95, and Croatia will be deciding whether Serbia fulfilled criteria for joining the European Union and closing.
It can block.
That can be a huge problem.
So we don't have here a lawyer who, and even if we had a lawyer, we do have lawyers, I'm sorry, but we don't have a lawyer who can answer these questions, who is so familiar. But Can something be done? No, obviously. Yes, Serbia is saying in the newspapers that they're going to try to see what are the efforts. But I don't see actually, and this obviously poses us here as the foundation in a lot of questions. How are we going to see the future of our work in those two countries and the other countries because one of our main strategies in those countries is dealing with the past. We deal with these things. We fund organizations that do it. So where is that going? Plus, of course, dealing on the human rights issues and so on. Judiciary, you know, when you were talking about the local courts, it is the foundations in those countries that have helped not establish those courts, but educate them. We have sent them to The Hague on many occasions so that they see how things are done. We translated books and so on and so on. So the legacy that Open Society Foundations have in those countries in the issue of dealing with the past is huge. So where are we now? This is what, you know, my office, it is very fortunate on one hand that the president of the Open Society Foundations is going to Kosovo in a week. This is the timing could not have been better, so that he actually can see on the spot you know, the situation. He's never been to Kosovo. This is his first visit to Pristina. So we are going to try to really kind of give him the briefing. Where is he going? And what are the consequences? He's been to Serbia and Bosnia, but this is his third visit to the Balkans in the last 6 months. So,
good timing,
and it's not because of Haradinaj. It was decided about a month ago. So actually, Masha and I were putting the briefing book yesterday, and then adding just the new material on Haradinaj. You know, but it's kind of add so that he has. Yeah. Anyway, so any more questions, Adna? No.
I have just one very quick question.
Please.
Sandra and Mario, when you were talking about, you know, what the EU needs to do to kind of incorporate some of these reconciliation issues more into how they approach their relations with these countries, you made a very quick reference to, oh, the State Department, you know, somewhat supports this and so on. So I was just curious about the role of the U.S. Obviously, it's not the player that it used to be, you know, not as important as the EU, but I was just wondering what is, you know, what role has the U.S. been playing? Are they, you know, not good on some things? What could they be better on and so on?
I mentioned the State Department because they some of the State Department's funds were given to the RECOM initiative for the signature collection campaign. But when it comes to the U.S.'s role now, for example, in Croatia, I think the policy is horrible. They support Croatia's accession to the EU for years now without a single problem, in a way. And they, if you ask Hillary Clinton, who just visited Zagreb, Croatia is not a model for the region, but a model for the world. In democratization, which I think is very funny when you look at it, but she actually said, I mean, so in that way the policy looks like that. But I just wanted to add one thing that is now getting forgotten after this Gotovina judgment, and as I said, for Croatia in a way a war is done. Croatia participated in a war in Bosnia and Herzegovina, as you probably know very well, between 92 and 94, especially. There was a conflict between Bosniaks and Croats. Croatian participation was, again, the court will say, but pretty obviously criminal. And we have no discussion about that whatsoever. No pressure from the European Union to at least apologize or give some recognition to these victims. We are now awaiting the judgment in Perlić and others' case, where there is one high-level Croatia army official being prosecuted. There is no discussion about that. I don't know when the judgment comes, if they will be given any public attention to that in that sense, because the European Union just does not, in a way, does not show that it cares to at least recognize, you know, there were crimes, there was criminal participation, there were victims. Sorry, at least that.
So back to Adna's question regarding the U.S. Position regarding Serbia, obviously. And also, I think, how is, again, a question without an answer, or maybe there is an answer, how is actually now the EU going to react to these judgments, because is Serbia going to get a date for the negotiations, for the starting of the negotiations or not, because that was actually postponed because of the ICTY, and they're not really collaboration with the ICTY. So there is a lot up in the air. So Sandra, can you comment on the U.S. position vis-a-vis?
Yeah, well, the Hillary Clinton visited Serbia a month ago, and the only topic in the agenda during conversation with Serbian politicians was negotiations with Kosovo on water issues. Not facing with the past, not reform of judicial, not just negotiations with the Kosovo. So
to
I
be continued.
To be continued, to encourage it, mm-hmm. and so on. So I think that receptivity of Serbian public about the reconciliation facing with the past, now it's on the lowest a level from, I don't know, 95 or 99. It's, I don't have a good answer on the question what is the next. Maybe now it's too early to give a definite answer regarding new strategies and prospects of reconciliation in the region, but I'm rethinking and thinking all the time what should we do now in this situation. You asked me about negotiations with Kosovo.
No, I just said I just said the date of the negotiations. Obviously, no, we know that the date. We hope that the negotiations between Kosovo and Serbia will continue, but obviously
it will be held on a technical level without any. I think Dačić is prepared to even shake hands with Haradinaj because he's determined. He's a very intelligent man. He knows that. Road to European Union now goes through Kosovo and negotiations with technical negotiations with Kosovo, and he knows that.
Yeah.
So, and it's obvious, even President Nikolic knows that, and they will do anything now.
Okay. Did you have enough of the Balkans?
Years ago.
Exactly. Anybody else? No?
I had one last
Please
question.
Yes.
A little bit about the last 2 points that were being made is kind of what can we at OSF be doing with our partners to help stimulate this public discussion more that seems that's falling off or that people have grown tired of or exhausted of because of these most recent rulings. What can we do to be supporting our groups to help them work to stimulate that again? And it sounds like that's a very big open question.
I know, and I think, and Sandra and I talked about how now it's crucial to continue this regional cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to these cases, I'm not sure there's an adequate substitute for judicial mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
And what my organization is definitely going to focus on is to try to build cases and press charges against the perpetrators of crimes in the Operation Storm.
Mm-hmm.
We have so far once pressed charges on command responsibility, not for the Operation Storm, but for the Operation Flash. So this will definitely be our focus. But as I said early, I'm not sure the Croatian institutions are capable of doing that. And now the Serbian Prosecution Office requested documentation from the ICTY about this case because there is a cooperation between domestic judicial institutions, but I'm not sure how that's going to go. And again, the judgment, if they publish the indictment, it's probably going to be political. It's not going to be, you know, very well supported. It has to be in Croatia in a way. So we are definitely going to focus on that, but because I think that the public discussion that is not followed by judicial mechanisms in this sense is just not going to do much.
Any ideas? What can we do more than we do?
Well, sincerely, I'm also tired from discussions among civil society, but we really need to see some steps and efforts from institutions. And I think now is a perfect time that European Union, who financially and politically supported the initiative for establishing regional commission, that now pushes this initiative. And I think there are some very positive signals from President of Croatia, Josipović, who said that Croatia needs to do something in accepting and acknowledging victims from. So I have some kind of silly hope that this is the time that something good actually can happen in terms of reconciliation in former Yugoslavia. But regional cooperation, that's crucial.
Which we always try to do, but it's not easy, as we know. And obviously, our offices locally, both in Serbia and Kosovo, and our Office of our Advisor in Croatia, as much, you know, we'll continue to try to do that and fund different organizations together with our network programs that can help. But we'll see. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mario and Sandra, for giving us your insight and your comments. And as you said yesterday, you're not looking very much going forward to going home because what's waiting there.
Yeah.
But I hope that the stay in New York
gives you a lot of things to learn, and that it was fun.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Adna. Thank you, Adna.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Good luck.
Now.